This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
So, my title tonight, I'm not 100% sure what my title is. I think it's been printed a couple different ways. The title that I'm going with tonight is Place, Space, and Grace, Musings on the Meaning of Home. As we say sometimes around here, we choose our titles way before we actually start writing our lectures, which gets us into trouble sometimes. I chose this topic, this title, and the write-up while I was on sabbatical in the fall. So it's made it a little tricky to revisit this. It's like, oh, what was I thinking back when I was on sabbatical? So I'm not sure if this lecture will meet your expectations based on what we put out there, but we'll do our best here. I'm also, for any of you, hoping that I will talk about homemaking or decorating or things like that. I'm not really going to be emphasizing that tonight, but I love reading design blogs, so if people want to talk about that afterwards, I'm happy to talk about it afterwards. I'm just not going to be really covering that in my lecture. So, but it's one of my favorite topics, so we can talk about it later. All right. On the wall of my apartment, which is in the house across the street, as the students here know, hangs a 5-foot-long framed map of the state of Tennessee. It was a gift from a New Yorker friend who purchased it when he lived in my hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee, for a year. He lived and worked down there for a year. Chattanooga didn't stick for him, but for some reason the map did, and he enough to bring it all the way back to New York with him. He kept it for a while, and then he decided that I would be the more appropriate owner of that map. And so I've had that for probably 15 years now. It's traveled to 3 apartments with me, and it's still proudly hanging on the wall. I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. When I was 11, my family moved out of the house that I had lived in most of my life and moved into a new house about 5 miles down the road. So not a big stretch. And that's where my parents still live. Just a few months after graduating college and a few weeks after turning the ripe age of 22, I packed my bags and I moved to Boston for graduate school. That was almost half my lifetime ago now, which is crazy to believe. And I'm still up here on the wrong side of the Mason-Dixon line. We can talk about that later if you want. I currently live in the house across the street, in my 5th apartment since moving to Massachusetts. That map on my wall every day stands as a very tangible symbol of my divided allegiance. Where is home for me? Is it Tennessee? Is it Boston? Is it the house I grew up in? Is it the apartment that I live in now? Yes to all of these, but also no. It's quite complicated. I've lived almost half my life, really more than that if you count college, away from my parents' house. Yet every time I go down there for a visit, my dad says, "We can't wait to have you home, baby." Despite my many, many years now living away from their home, signs of my formative years with them in that house are apparent all over my life. My southern accent, that 20-plus years of New England life can't quite seem to snuff out. It has a lot, but not totally. A love for church and friends and family and hospitality that was given to me from a very early age. My father's tendency to live in the midst of piles of stuff. And my mother's tendency every so often to sweep through and say, enough, and just get rid of all the piles. Both of those things are in me. I've moved far away, but my ties to those people and that place and that house and that city and that season still run very, very strong in me. Several weeks ago, I was driving from Wellesley to Southboro on Route 9. Some of you guys may know that stretch. I was driving through Natick, and I got stuck in some pretty heavy late afternoon traffic. And so as I slowed, and I was just at a standstill on Route 9 in Natick, I looked over, and I noticed to the right, on the westbound side of Route 9, there were two strip mall kind of things. And I noticed that between these two strip malls, every single store had something to do with homes and houses. There was a high-end furniture shop. There were two stores that sold, like, rugs and floor coverings. There was a fireplace shop. There was a window shop, a couple other places. And at the same time, I had the radio on in my car, and I was listening to NPR, and they were doing a story about the immigration crisis at the U.S. southern border and the plans for a border wall. And I was just struck by the discord between those two things. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, store after store after store offering ways to make our homes more comfortable and functional and beautiful. And on the other hand, these stories that we're seeing on the news day after day after day of people desperately fleeing their homes because of corruption and violence. And that to me is quite a picture of these two extremes. On the one hand, immigrants, refugees, the homeless population, these are huge issues all over the world, in our country, in our cities. People who, for various reasons, do not have homes, do not have actual homes. And on the other hand, I was thinking about, for those of you who are familiar with Boston, the big stately row houses in the Beacon Hill neighborhood of Boston. And many of those homes never go on the real estate market because they're passed through families generation to generation to generation. So whole families who have a place where they live for generations. I don't know all of you here tonight. I know some of you and some of your stories. I don't know all of you. And perhaps some of you have experienced life in one of those two extreme places. I don't know. But the reality is that most of us live somewhere in between. Gone are the days when most people were born and raised and died in the same house or at least the same city. Divorce rates continue to climb, and Americans are more transient than ever. Here at LaBrie, we have noticed a trend that we kind of refer to as modern homelessness in some of our students. Students who come to stay at LaBrie, but they don't necessarily have a place to go when they leave, when term ends. For many of them, their parents' home is not an option for whatever reason. And work or education or relationships have taken them to a variety of places, but they've never really put down roots, and they don't feel like they have a place. Theologian Walter Brueggemann says that our biggest existential crisis is rootlessness. And that feels true to me. But in the midst of all this transience, Americans are obsessed with HGTV and the Food Network. There are multiple shows on multiple networks that have to do with elements of home. Shopping for homes, trying to find the best deals, fixer-upper and repair shows, cooking how-tos, cooking competitions. The trend in houses now is for open concept kitchens, often containing restaurant quality, high-end appliances, despite the fact that Americans are spending less and less time in the kitchen. In the 1950s, women, primarily women, spent 50 to 60% of their time on food preparation and cooking. And now the average American spends less than 6 hours a week on food preparation at home. Not if you're a LaBrie worker, but the average American. And honestly, in the midst of our busy culture, no one's really home at all. My colleague Marty Kies, who's not here tonight, often says when she talks about hospitality that the problem with hospitality is that nobody's at home. And that feels true as well. There are cliches and quotes about home all around us. I have to look it up on Pinterest, put it in Google. From songs to greeting cards to Instagram posts. So here's a couple that should sound familiar to most of you. Home is where the heart is. Home is wherever I'm with you. You can never go home again. And my favorite, which is, home is where the tacos are. But one of the most poignant quotes, statements about home, comes from the American poet Robert Frost. His poem, The Death of the Hired Man, is a conversation between a husband and a wife, discussing a former friend and employee who seemingly left them high and dry, only to return later in life in a time of need and great vulnerability. The man has returned unannounced, and this couple is arguing / discussing about whether or not they should take him back in. In a rather well-known line from the poem, the husband says, "Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in." Mm-hmm. You guys might have heard that before. Less known is his wife's response about her idea of home. She says, "I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve." I find Frost's lines here a good parallel with the Bible's framework for the idea of home. If you are one of the people who likes to dive into biblical topics by doing a word study, you'll come up fairly short here. If you do a word study on the use of the words house and home in the Bible, you will find that most of the time they are simply referring to a physical structure where someone lives. Sometimes the phrase house of the Lord is used, almost always referring to the temple, sometimes referring to heaven, the New Jerusalem. So to understand what the Bible has to say about home, we really need to scope out to like a 10,000 foot view and look at the full arc of the biblical narrative. Like Frost's poem, the story of the Bible is really a story at its essence about homecoming. A home that's not deserved, but nonetheless a home that is given, a home that is lost, and a home that is restored. We can't really talk about home without talking about place. At its essence, home is a physical structure that is located in time and space, a place where an individual, a group of people, or family reside and keep their personal belongings, usually. Along with food, shelter is the most basic of human needs. We can't survive long, we can't survive well without it. We all need a place for our bodies to be. Most of us move around the world quite a bit throughout the day, but we are quite vulnerable. At night, and in any kind of weather, really, we need shelter and we need a place to sleep. This is part of the tragedy of homelessness, especially chronic homelessness, is that aside from the negative cognitive, social, and mental health issues that come along with the stress of not having a home, the physical bodies of people who are homeless tend to break down much more quickly than those of us who are not. Our bodies need to be protected. We're quite vulnerable. Home is kind of our default location. It implies a certain level of both permanence as well as privacy to a certain degree. Some people actually spend more time during the day, more hours during the day in their office than they do at home. And many spend hours every day in their cars. That might be some of you. But they still do not consider their offices or their cars a home, right? It can be tempting, though. I was thinking that when I was in graduate school, I spent so many hours a day at school that my classmates and I all wondered why we were paying exorbitant rent in Boston to live in apartments that we were never in. And we talked about we need to just roll out sleeping bags, pull our money for coffee pot and like a hot plate, and we'll move on to the sixth floor of Sargent College at Boston University. Great views up there, by the way, of the river in Cambridge. But even for those of us who've moved around a lot, the idea of home in its truest form has a sense of permanence to it. Here at LaBrie, we tell the students staying with us that we want them to feel at home. But quickly after that, we also remind them that this isn't their home. And would they please not move the furniture, take art off the walls, move things around, okay? There's a difference between feeling at home and actually being home, okay? Our idea of home is also shaped by what the structure is like and where it's located. Is our home an apartment, one of many other apartments in a high-rise building, in a busy city block surrounded by people and shops and activity? Or is our home a house in a neighborhood or in the country surrounded by more plants than people and more silence than noise? Is our home a place of peace and safety? Or is it a place of insecurity and violence? These aspects of place matter as these differences radically shape us in ways that we are sometimes conscious of and other times not. My experience growing up in a family of four in a house in the mountains of East Tennessee was quite different than my map-gifting friend who grew up in a family of eight in an apartment on the Upper East Side of New York City. We were shaped very differently by our places that we came from. And place is central to our idea of home because it is a key aspect of the biblical narrative. Perhaps the biggest overarching theme in the Bible. We can argue that, but it's one of them. There are many moments within the biblical story where place is an important factor, but I want to highlight three places that are really central to human beings and to our story as human beings. The first two come right at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis 1 and 2. As the story opens, God is making a home. He's making a place that is habitable for humans to live in, a place that is very good. In her book, Keeping Place, I'm going to refer to this quite a bit, but Jen Pollock Michelle, it's a book called Keeping Place, Reflections on the Meaning of Home, which I would highly recommend. It's a great book. But in that book, she says this, while God deserved a universe befitting only himself, though he could have rightfully created galaxies whose only purpose was to showcase his glory, he created an oxygenated world because it suited us. Creation was only good insofar as it could be home to humanity. And you see that in Genesis. If you read Genesis 1 and 2 and you see this pattern of God creating and calling it good and creating and calling it good, he's creating a habitable place, not for himself, but for us. His first act of creation was to create a home for us. He created the cosmos, and within the cosmos, the earth, and on the earth, a garden. The Garden of Eden, full of vegetation, food, and animals, a place for humans to live and to thrive, and most importantly, a place for humans to dwell with God in the midst of his creation. God showed himself from the very first pages of the Bible to be both a creator as well as a host. The second significant place that God created, also at the beginning of Genesis, was our physical bodies. Along with our souls, our hearts, our minds, which kind of get all the attention, we were made embodied. We were never created or intended to be disembodied spirit-like beings floating around the cosmos. That was never the plan. That was never the story. From the beginning, God gave each of us our own place to live in and through our bodies, our bones, our ligaments, our muscles, water, skin, blood. It's interesting to think of our bodies as being a type of home. It made me think of like being in a preschool classroom where you're talking about turtles and snails and animals that take their homes with them wherever they go, right? But I think it's important to note that home isn't just something out there. It's not just an external place. The idea of being physically bound and connected is how we are built. It's intrinsic to being human, and it's intrinsic to this idea of home. People sometimes talk of not being at home in their own bodies, and go to great lengths sometimes to try to detach themselves from the physical reality of having a body and having a broken body, which is the only choice any of us have, is to have a broken body. I'm not going to say much more about this. We can talk about that more in the discussion if you want, but I just wanted to flag it because I do think it's a really important factor in God making a physical place for us. And the third significant place in the biblical narrative comes at the very end of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And this is where we get a glimpse into the vision that John the disciple has of our final destination, which is Zion, the city of God, the New Jerusalem, or heaven, if you will. But again, this is not an image of a sky with clouds and angel-like beings flying around. This is a very real place. It is a city with rivers, gates, walls, and the best thing of all, a table. Full of embodied people sitting at the table at the wedding feast of the Lamb. So people still in bodies, people still in a place, even at the end of the biblical story. So the biblical narrative is bookended by these two or three, if you will, significant places. And as we look to the Bible to inform our understanding of reality, we can see that God thought place was really important. Place grounds us and it frames our entire story. In the same way that growing up in a house in the mountains of East Tennessee has grounded my story in a particular way, these bookends to the biblical narrative ground our reality and our existence as well. And most importantly, it grounds us in God. It binds us to other people, but it also binds us to God. Home is the place where we are tethered. This is the word that kept coming to my mind as I was going through these things, this idea of being tethered. It's a place that we launch from, that we learn and we grow and we explore. We have adventures, we transform, we bless, but it's also the place that we return to over and over and over. The image that I had in my mind was, what do you call it? Bungee jumping? I've never do that. But that idea of bungee jumping, of this platform that you send yourself out from, but there is this attachment, right? That you come back and you can jump again if you want. But this attachment, you come back. The day before all the students arrived at LaBrie this term, as has become our custom, it's a great one, those of us, the workers and our helper Ingrid, spent some time just walking through the house and the property and praying over the house and through the house and for our property. We recognize that every space in this house serves a different purpose. And we prayed that God would be at work in each of those particular places in particular ways. In this library, we prayed for alert minds, able to understand and absorb the new information that's encountered here. In the bedrooms, we prayed for good conversations and undisturbed sleep for the people staying there. In the bathrooms, we prayed over our aging plumbing system, that it would continue to work as designed while the students here, at least till the end of the term. In the front hall out here, we prayed for all who would come through our red door during this term, passing through the house even briefly. And in case it's not obvious, that includes all of you who have come through our door tonight. We're covered in that prayer. But you'll notice that when we prayed for the library, we didn't pray for good sleep. Because we have particular hopes that for what God might bestow on those who come into this room, and sleep is not one of those things. It does happen sometimes, but that's not what we're going for in here. While we were in the bedrooms, we didn't pray for the pipes, because we don't want water running freely through the bedrooms. That's not what we want. So my point here is that space matters. Place matters, But space matters as well, how we inhabit our places. In his book, The Space Between, A Christian Engagement with the Built Environment, Eric Jacobson says this: the way that humans tend to live on the land can be understood as a kind of habitat that is not unlike the habitat of other creatures. When their habitats are lacking in certain key characteristics, humans tend to languish. And when habitats are in an optimal state, they tend to thrive. One of the benefits of paying attention to the built environment is that it can help us think through settings that support human thriving. Urbanism is about the placement of buildings and how they shape the space around them. We live much of our lives in the spaces between the buildings. And I would add to that, we live in the spaces between the walls. The walls are important, but we live our lives between the walls, between the buildings. That same day that we were praying together, we were in the tile room right here, looking up to our house on Lover's Lane and Dick's cabin across the road. And while we were praying, Dick actually, I just flagged this, having this lecture in the back of my head, Dick offered a thanksgiving to God for the beauty of our property, and specifically for the architecture of this house and of the house and the cabin across the street. He noted that just the gift of such beauty, but also the way that the space and land and size and the aesthetics of our three buildings shape our shared life here. We often thank God that he has gifted LaBrie with beautiful properties at each branch. Those of you who've been to other branches of LaBrie know that they are all quite different in geography and structure and makeup, but they are all quite beautiful in their own way. And that we see as a real blessing and gift from God. We know that our first space, the garden, was a lush and vibrant home. It was full of sights and smells and sounds and tastes that facilitated a flourishing relationship between man and God. God could have plopped humans onto a vast expanse of bare dirt, but he took care, it seems he took considerable care, to create a home that was not just functional for life, but also enjoyable. Not only did the garden require, not only did the garden include everything that humans needed to survive, but it was beautiful and very intentional as well. God cares about the beauty of our spaces. In Exodus, a full 6 chapters are dedicated to describing the very detailed measurements and decorations of the tabernacle. Similar instructions appear in 1 Kings regarding the building of the temple, Solomon's temple. Here's just one excerpt. This is in regards to the tabernacle. This is from Exodus 26. Make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of finely twisted linen and blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, with cherubim woven into them by a skilled worker. All the curtains are to be the same size, 28 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. Join 5 of the curtains together and do the same with the other 5. Make loops of blue material along the edge of the end curtain in one set and do the same with the end curtain in the other set. Make 50 loops on one curtain and 50 loops on the end curtain of the other set, with the loops opposite each other. Then make 50 gold clasps and use them to fasten the curtains together so that the tabernacle is a unit. There's a lot of detail in there, and I just read 6 verses out of 6 chapters that go on like that. God cares about the beauty and the function and the details of our spaces. I don't want to give the impression that a house must be perfectly curated to be a home. It doesn't. Some of the most perfect, visually stunning homes that I've ever been in have been the least welcoming and the least home-like. And you guys probably have experienced that to a certain degree as well. But spaces do matter. We are significantly impacted by them. How are we to eat well enough to nourish our bodies and to share community together if our spaces do not contain ovens or tables or chairs? How can our bodies get the rest they require without beds or comfortable places to sleep? How can we care well for our bodies without showers or tubs or sinks? Spaces also shape our actions. Very different things will happen in a living room where all of the furniture is oriented toward a television versus all of the furniture being arranged to face each other in order to facilitate interaction and conversation between those who sit there. When you guys come, those of you who aren't at Liberty all the time, when you come on Friday nights, this is how we have this room set up. But the other 6.5 days of the week, most of the chairs that you're sitting in are out on the porch, and most of our furniture is arranged in a semicircle around the stove so that students can sit around that and talk. We would be doing something very differently at Liberty if this room was set up this way with the furniture all the time. Mm-hmm. Spaces that are small with few windows and poor lighting can make us feel claustrophobic and tense, and we kind of do what we need to do and then get out of the space as soon as possible. So it's significant as to whether or not we can live and be and thrive in spaces based on how they're set up. It's not just what decorates the walls or a table, of course. It's also the people that inhabit the space with us. That the way people live together in a space, whether it's an apartment or a city block or a neighborhood, again, goes a long way to shaping us. Pastor Scott Sauls says that home is also the people you travel with and live alongside as you move from place to place. Again, I'm not going to do a lot with this tonight, but people are very much a part of this dynamic that we're talking about. A functional and nurturing of homes and home space requires a care, intentional care of space and of people in order to push back against decay and inertia. We can probably all picture a house that we've actually seen or in a movie or a television show of like that decrepit house that's like crumbling and there's like plants growing through the cracks in the wall. And, you know, the neighborhood kids on the street are, they're like, oh, there's a witch that lives there, whatever, right? It doesn't take long for houses to give in to that. If you're a homeowner, you know that. Several of my colleagues here at Liberty spend a significant amount of their time during weeks trying to push back inertia and decay off of this house that you're sitting in, one of the newest parts of this house, which was early 1900s. And that's our new wing of the house. So a lot of work goes into that. Here at Liberty, we clean the bathrooms at least 3 to 4 times a week. And students sometimes complain when they're asked to clean the bathrooms. They're like, but it was just cleaned. But with the number of people who live in this house, it goes downhill really fast, really, really fast. And we could very easily become completely overwhelmed by dirty sinks and piles of dishes and loads of laundry if we didn't stay on top of it all. This is the traditional work of housekeeping. And we see in the Bible that God is not only a homemaker, but he is a housekeeper as well. He is the ultimate caretaker, keeping careful watch on his creation, working to make it and keep it beautiful and functional. A few weeks ago at my lunch table, we were having a discussion, and one of the things that came up was the idea that some of you guys may be familiar with of God as kind of the cosmic watchmaker, a creator who made his creation and he set it in motion and then he walked away. But as I read the biblical story, I see a God who is perpetually putting his hand on things, moving this here and moving that there and fussing over the cares of the places and spaces he has brought into existence. He's given man dominion over these spaces as well, but we have frequently abdicated our responsibility to care well for the home he's given us. But despite that, God is still busy at the work of keeping house. And as much as God's priority of place and space is evident, even in the Bible, the reality of homelessness is unfortunately a reality. while God made us a very good home, we are not in that home anymore. We were made to live in a world of perfect peace and harmony with God, but we chose to live life on our own terms. And as a result, we are no longer fully at home in the world that He made. This is the home that God created for us, but at the same time, we're no longer at home in that world. Between Genesis and Revelation, between the garden and the city, our story is marked by homelessness and exile. We live in the reality of the now and not yet. Christ has come, and He is at work in the world, but He has not yet returned to redeem creation in all of its fullness. So we live in the simultaneous reality of being at home, but not. Just as I talked about the importance of place in the biblical story, displacement and exile are equally important. We see this idea of displacement and exile all through the biblical narrative. There are so many examples of this. I'm going to just mention a few. I couldn't even begin to mention them all. If you read the Bible through the lens of exile, you'll start seeing it everywhere. The first, obviously, is Adam and Eve's eviction from the garden. That is the first exile. A little bit later in Genesis, we have Abraham being sent out from his home to an unknown place. We have the story of Joseph, who was sold at a young age into slavery by his brothers and spent many, many years in slavery and wandering and trying to find a place, which he did finally. But it wasn't his home. It wasn't the place he started from. Our friends, the Israelites, big time, they spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And a bit later in the Old Testament, we see their actual exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. And even in the New Testament, Jesus says about himself, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Mm-hmm. So this is something that Jesus experienced as well in his time on earth. Not having a home, not having a place. We even feel the effects of exile from our own bodies through disease and pain, mental health struggles, infertility, all kinds of ways that we feel that exile in our bodies. So at the same time that we are all at home, we are simultaneously searching for home as well. And this is often, this kind of feeling or sense is often described by the word nostalgia. Sometimes nostalgia has a connotation, kind of like sentimentality, the idea of looking back at something with rose-colored glasses. But according to Anthony Esselin in his book of the same name, Nostalgia, at its root, that word means pain for the return or ache for the homecoming. There's this element, it's not so much rose-colored glasses. There's a painful ache that is embedded in the use of that word and an ache for home. There's two words, as I'm told, I don't speak German, used in German that get to this idea, and one means home woe, W-O-E, and the other means seeking to see again. In English, it is homesickness. So almost any book that you read on this idea of home will, almost everyone I read, had a bit in it about different words in different languages, and they all said the English word just doesn't capture it, as is often the case. In English, it doesn't capture it in the way that some of these other languages do. But it's this ache to turn back for home. We are looking for a place where we can be fully known, fully ourselves, and fully at rest. And no matter how great our relationships are or how cute our apartment is, we all live with this deep ache that we are not fully at home. We move from one season of life to the next, but the longing remains. I was talking to a friend last week on the telephone. She's someone I've been friends with for a long time. And she got married and she became a mother rather late in her life. And she was telling me how she's in a season right now where she has all the things that she's always wanted, but she feels lonelier than she ever has in her entire life. And she's really struggling with the discord of that. That longing for home is real. And we spend our days searching for home in people, in our work, in art, in our accomplishments. And sometimes we get close, right? We stumble across a taste or a smell or a conversation or an experience that conjures a memory of home. Sometimes it's a home that we have actually experienced. And sometimes it feels like it's a memory of that kind of existential home, that home that's in our DNA. I was talking with one of our students the other day, and he used the analogy of having moments that feel transcendent, like you're almost able to reach out and touch the edge of something, like the fringe of a piece of cloth or something, but then it slips away. I don't know if that sounds familiar to you guys, but it resonated with me. Tim Keller says it this way. He says, "We are all exiles, always longing for home. We are always traveling, but never arriving. The houses and families we actually inhabit are only inns along the way, but they aren't home. Home continues to evade us. We have been living in a world that no longer fits our deepest longings." Scott Saul says it this way, "The places and people we call home are pointers, but they are not the point." As he often does, C.S. Lewis gets at this idea very well. I'm going to read a bit of an extended quote from him. He's talking here in The Weight of Glory, like The Weight of Glory, his essay, The Weight of Glory, about our longing for our own far-off country. That's the language that he uses. Our commonest expedient is to call it beauty and behave as if that had settled the matter. Wordsworth's expedient was to identify it with certain moments in his own past, but all this is a cheat. If Wordsworth had gone back to those moments in the past, he would not have found the thing itself, but only the reminder of it. What he remembered would turn out to be itself a remembering. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. And he goes on, skipping ahead a bit. Apparently, then, our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside, is no mere neurotic fancy, but the truest index of our real situation. And to be at last summoned inside would be both glory and honor beyond all our merits, and also the healing of that old ache.
Can you read that last bit one more time?
Apparently, then, our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside, is no mere neurotic fancy, but the truest index of our real situation. And to be at last summoned inside would be both glory and honor beyond all our merits, and also the healing of that old ache. That idea of being on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside was like, that hits for me, at least. So what do we do? as wanderers who are living in exile. Well, there's hope. In Jeremiah 29, while Israel was actually in exile from their home in Jerusalem, living in Babylon, the prophet gave them advice for how to live in exile in their adopted city. He said, "Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper." I think this passage is so important. This is a picture of grace. Even in our exile, God makes a way for us to prosper and thrive. He is always making things new. And this idea that our prosperity is closely tied to the prosperity of the place that we are in exile. It's not a place that we're meant to turn our backs on, sit tightly, and just wait till it all passes away. We are meant to engage and to seek the prosperity of the city. There's some Christians who don't do this very well. I have a different idea about that. We were placed in our bodies in the garden, and we were displaced in exile, but we will be returned to a permanent home in the city of God. God is working to bring us home, but not back to the garden. He's doing something new. Home is where we started, and home is where we will end. But home is also God's grace to us now, in between the garden and the city. Jen Pollock Michelle says that when we long for home, she says, we long for home because it was our first gift of grace, and it will be our last. Even as we know the reality of living as exiles, things are not right between the garden and the city. We don't have to look far to know that that's the truth. God has given us the gift of home now through the houses and apartments that are ours, even temporarily, through the comforts of friends, of family, of tables, food, cozy blankets and cups of tea that make us feel at home even in the midst of brokenness. We receive the gifts of beautiful art, of nourishing conversations, and shared laughter that all serve as reminders of the home that was lost, but are also signposts of the home that is to come. That's what Lewis is getting at there. And in the midst of all of these things, the Bible assures us that Jesus is in fact with us. Anna shared this with me. In his book, The Rest of God, Mark Buchanan suggests this practice. He says, "How aware have you been right now that Jesus is with you? Why don't you greet him out loud, or if that's awkward for you, in your heart? Even if you were sitting somewhere public, a cafe, a subway, a city square, a quiet library, or a noisy marketplace, do this. I am always amazed at the thrill of homecoming it awakens in me." One of the great paradoxes of the Christian faith is that God, the God of the universe, became a refugee himself in order to dwell with us as Emmanuel. He left his home, which was union with the Father and the Spirit, to make his home with us. And when we ask him, he will make his home within our hearts while simultaneously inviting us to a seat at the banquet in the Lord's house. Revelation 3 says, "See, I have placed before you an open door that no one else can shut." We are invited in. The door is open. John 14, Jesus said, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, but trust also in me. In my Father's house there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you." N.T. Wright says that Jesus uses this expression to assure his disciples that, yes, there will be enough room for everyone who wants to come. This isn't turning up at a hotel late at night and getting a no vacancy sign, or arriving to a dinner party where they didn't get your RSVP and they're a seat short and you're left awkwardly standing in a corner. That has happened to me before. The joy of the gospel is that we are homeless wanderers no more. Jesus is here with us now, and he will come back. And when he does, there will be plenty of room for all who choose to go with him. Time and time again through Scripture, God invites his people to be with him. He makes places for them to inhabit, to rest in his care, and even when they turn away, complain, and reject his offers of hospitality and homecoming. Jen Pollock Michelle says, "Return, repentance, rest. These are the siren melodies of the prophets. For as long as there is a compassionate father, there will be a home, a table, and a feast. The first improbable gift of grace is hospitality, and it is the last as well." In the Old Testament, we see that God goes down to dwell with his people in the tabernacle, in the temple. In the New Testament, God comes down in Jesus. Aside from the passage that I just read in John 14, the other time in the Gospel of John that Jesus uses the phrase, "my Father's house," he is referring to the temple, to the actual temple. But in the final day, God invites us to dwell with him in the city of God. And in Revelation 21, the disciple John says, "I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple." God is our home, and all of this is grace to us. I want to close here by reading a passage in a psalm and a prayer, but really both prayers, I think. The first thing I want to read is Psalm 84. "How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found a home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar. O Lord Almighty, my King and my God, blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, who have set their hearts on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. Hear my prayer, O Lord God Almighty. Listen to me, O God of Jacob. Look upon our shield, O God. Look with favor on your anointed one. Better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord bestows favor and honor. No good thing does he withhold from those whose walk is blameless. O Lord Almighty, blessed is the man who trusts in you." That is a beautiful picture of the home that God offers to all of us. And the last thing that I want to read is a prayer. It's from this book, Every Moment Holy, by Doug McKelvey. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this book. It's a really beautiful. It's pretty new. It just came out about a year or two ago. It's a book of liturgies that he's written for really non-traditional moments in life. And we have really come to love it at Liberty. I've really loved it personally. There's actually a beautiful liturgy in here for those who are struggling with homesickness. That's not the one I'm going to read, but it's great. The one I'm going to read is a liturgy for moving into a new home. And I think it's just a helpful framing of the biblical picture of what the home is that God is offering us in the new heavens and the new earth, but also a good frame for how to think about our homes here on earth while we're here, how to think about that. So I'll pray this and then we'll close. We thank you for this home, O Lord, for the shelter it will provide, for the moments of life that will be shared within it. We thank you for this, our new home, and we welcome you here. Dwell with us in this place, O Lord. Dwell among us in these spaces, in these rooms. Be present at this table as we eat together. Be present as we rise in the morning and lie down at night. Be present in our work here. Be present in our play. May your spirit inhabit this home, making of it a sanctuary where hearts and lives are knit together, where bonds of love are strengthened, where mercy is learned and practiced. May this, our home, be a harbor of anchorage and refuge, and a haven from which we journey forth to do your work in the world. May it be a garden of nourishment in which our roots go deep, that we might bear fruit for the nourishing of others. May this, our new home, be a place of knowing and of being known, a place of shared tears and laughter, a place where forgiveness is easily asked and granted, and wounds are quickly healed, a place of meaningful conversation, of words not left unsaid, a place of joining, of becoming, of creating and reflecting, a place where our diverse gifts are named and appreciated, where we learn to serve one another and to serve our neighbors as well, a place where our stories are forever twined by true affectations. Grant also, O Lord, that our days lived gratefully within these temporary walls, enjoying these momentary fellowships, would serve to awaken within us a restless longing for our truer home. Incline our hearts ever toward the glories of that better city built by you, O God, a city whose blessings are never ending and whose fellowships are eternally unbroken. Amen. That's where I'm going to stop. For those of you who are new to LaBrie, we just like to spend time after these Friday night lectures having an open discussion. You can ask a question. You can make a comment. You're welcome to push back on anything. This is the second public lecture I've given today. So I'm going to keep going as long as I can. So we'll keep going until you run out of questions or I run out of energy. I don't know what will happen first. But if you need to go, please feel free to go. You don't feel like you have to stay till, you don't have to stay till the bitter end. But we'd love to just chat a bit, before you do go. So open it up. Yeah, it's called Every Moment Holy. And the guy who wrote it is Doug McKelvey, McKelvey.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
What was the title of that one that you wrote, that you read?
It was A Liturgy for a New Home. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there is another one in there for those suffering with homesickness. Yeah. Other things? Richard, do you have questions?
I guess I'm mildly surprised that you did not speak of the prodigal son and his homecoming.
Mm-hmm. You're correct, I did not. Do you have something you want to say about that? It was just more of...
I guess
wasn't
perhaps
strategic.
Illustratable by a numerous sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also was reminded of the verse in the 13th chapter of the letter to the Hebrews, where it points out that Jesus was executed outside of the city.
Mm.
And related to the Old Testament practice of burning things outside the camp. And then it goes on to say, here on earth we have no continuing place.
Mm.
Howbeit, we seek one. Come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That there's always some seeking function that we're doing in this world.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. Absolutely. Yeah, I'll go back to the prodigal son. I'm be totally honest, that was just more a factor of time than anything else, but the prodigal son is the kind of premier New Testament story, if you will, on homelessness and homecoming. It's an interesting story there about the younger son who chooses to leave, right? It's very much in certain ways a mirroring of the Garden of Eden. The son who no longer wants to live under the structures and the guidance of the father. And so he chooses his own way. And he chooses to leave the home and the land, but then chooses to return. And it is a beautiful picture of this return that is like in the Frost poem, you know, not deserved, but it's very much given and bestowed anyway, and the delight of homecoming, and to mirror God's delight in our homecoming to him, both now when we choose him now, and then when the day comes that we will be welcomed in to the city. Sarah.
As you were just recounting that, it made me think of the older brother who's at home, but then is mad because he's not at home somehow.
Yeah.
Like he's not, he somehow doesn't live as if he has all of the privileges that he has.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of either, I don't know, exempting himself, but then being entitled or,
I'm like,
that's a good point.
And the father as well. The father's living in that tension as well of having this intact home, not quite, because one of his children is outside of that.
I hadn't thought about it, but once the prodigal son came up, also the concept of adoption as well. God welcoming us home.
Yeah.
When we don't have a home.
Absolutely. The idea of being grafted in. Mm-hmm. That's the language that's used. Yeah. Of being grafted into the family of God and being welcomed in as sons and daughters. When again, we have no right to be called sons and daughters, but God bestows that on us as well.
Can you comment on maybe the best way to think about or go about striking the balance between this Jeremiah 29 concept of seeking the welfare of your exile, the place you've been sent, or the place you choose to be outside of your home, but also C.S. Lewis's concept of like, don't confuse these temporal things for what's like, where is, I get it, but I'm not quite there as far as like, where do you find yourself being so wrapped up in the welfare of where you are that you lose sight of, that you start playing with mud pies instead of the great gifts you've been given?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a fine line. I think the root of it, I think most of us probably err on the side of being too focused on the world. That's probably the side that we would fall off on. So my gut on that is to say, to somehow be intentional about always keeping before you this idea of the eternal city of God. That feels like the work in that, of keeping the eternal city and the, and I think also, you know, it's also the recognition that the work that we do here, in engaging in relationships and families and seeking the welfare of the city, ultimately, the prospering that comes from that is ultimately the work of God, right? That we are invited to partner with him. We are invited into that work. That's something we talk about at Labrie sometimes, those of us who work here, and we can get like, Labrie, you know, with our hands on it like this. And it's like, you know, Labrie isn't ours. Labrie is God's. And we have the privilege of joining him and of partnering with him in the work. And we have, we all have very real gifts and talents and skills that we can employ, and it does matter if we show up or not. It does matter if we do the work. God doesn't just sort of magically, right? We have a will. We can choose to participate or not participate. So I don't want to say it's just sort of all God and has nothing to do with us. But at the end of the day, that the way that we are equipped comes from God, and that He is the one who is going to bring the fruit and bring the prospering.
Yeah, I think maybe just thinking about it as you were talking, like, I have it flipped, right? Like, and so I'm seeking the welfare of the city, I'm seeking what the city defines as its welfare, as opposed to bringing God's welfare into it, right? And being a people set apart and bringing that into, you know, where you are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think just kind of an example of that. The book that I referenced, the Eric Jacobson book on the kind of Christian approach to the built environment, I'm interested in this idea of space and how space is used and how it shapes us and urban planning and things like that. And I took a graduate class this fall, and I wrote a paper on it was a class on essentially food and theology, and I could write my final paper on anything, and I chose to write on kind of food injustice in the city, urban food injustice. And this is just a concrete example of what you're talking about, because what in the realm of food and the idea of a prospering city is in many, it's super complicated, but in many low-income neighborhoods, in neighborhoods that are majority people of color living there, it is very hard to access fresh fruits and vegetables, things that are healthy, because big grocery stores have moved out. They're in the suburbs. And big grocery stores have taken away the mom and pop, like the local mom and pop kind of mercantile kind of store no longer exists. These large grocery store chains have a monopoly on food distribution as well. And so people are living in areas of cities where their only choice for buying food is like a fast food restaurant or a corner market. And that's an example to me of what the city is determining is that we want to use real estate for this, and we want to, you know, how are we going to maximize our profit margins, and how, right? That's how we're judging what's best for the city. But the reality is that so far from any kind of biblical picture of God's physical provision of food for His people, and the inequality and injustice that sits there, right? And so, my thought would be, a biblical view of that kind of prospering the city would not be what the mayor of Boston necessarily says prospering the city. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, Lenny.
Other thought.
Yeah.
It's also that I see the role of the church that was really fulfilling its role, and the participation of the people involved in helping the city, the secular city, come together and experience that longing for home together. I think of some of the songs that we get in the Psalms of the people who are in exile. We lay down and wept for thee, Zion, by the waters of Babylon.
Yeah.
And that coming together, we remind ourselves, each other, this is not our home, and put our focus on what our true home is. That's one of the functions of a church.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, thank you. Marta?
So just the backdrop, so I'm from Hungary, and I lived there for 30 years, and I lived 10 years in England, and we moved here about almost 4 years ago. So I've been thinking about home, and, where is the place of home, and I really appreciate, the spiritual sort of overarching theme of, homecoming and, those thoughts that you talked about. But at the same time, that's an encouraging thought that we are all strangers, whether I'm home, I'm not home, we are all strangers together on a journey. Okay? But at the same time, I feel like that there is some quality to home and being able to be home, that is a very different quality than when you are taken out of the space. So it's like, you know, as you say, that we are embodied spirits and our culture and our physical environment, the buildings, the geography, the weather, the food, the culture, mm-hmm. the language, that all shape us.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like if I'm taken out of that environment, it's like, you know, the children toys when you have to fit the right shape in, I feel like I'm a rectangular trying to be pushed into a circle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can take yourself out of that. So I feel like even if you have a home in a country and you never leave that home, you are born and raised and die in the same house, you are still a stranger, okay,
mm-hmm.
in a spiritual sense, and that's the real thing. But there is a quality or there is something that's different about you mm-hmm. than if you are moving all around,
yeah.
added to the fact that you are actually a stranger spiritually as well as physically.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like it takes a huge amount of energy
mm-hmm.
to always try to figure out what's going on around
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm still trying to think, is it something that I need to grieve, or I just need to think like, oh, but the spiritual reality is that mm-hmm. we are all strangers, and
mm-hmm.
we all, you know, but I would never sort of advise my children like saying, it doesn't matter where you live, you can live here,
mm-hmm.
you can live there,
mm-hmm.
you can live in this country. I would still say to them, you know, put down roots and stick to one place and
mm-hmm.
to one group of people
mm-hmm.
and be faithful in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there is still the double reality of, you know, what is true in a biblical sense
mm-hmm.
and in an overarching spiritual, transcendent, you know, just
mm-hmm.
eternal sense, but there is still a physical reality of home
yeah.
that's important. And I think
mm-hmm.
certain cultures are losing that more than others, and there is
yeah.
more
mm-hmm.
transience now, and I think it actually impacts us.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, how much does it matter? Does it matter, you think,
mm-hmm.
where we live and where we are and
mm-hmm.
how much we move around and in what ways does it actually influence us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it make sense what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I have a clean answer for that, but I think I would say yes to all of that. I mean, I think, I mean, your question about is it something worth grieving, like this kind of thing, I would say yes. A loss of home is always something to grieve. So whether on a kind of day-to-day here on this earth tangible level or on a theological side, a loss of home is something to grieve. And I think this is the challenge, isn't it? This is the challenge of like life in the West in 2019. It's just such a transient place. And I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. Dick did a lecture a number of years ago on community. And one of the things that I kind of hung on to from that lecture is he said that the economy gets the best of us, right? And so we're very willing to move for a job or a promotion or, right, for money. We move for money. And we're much less likely to say no to those things and to either stay put or move someplace because we have friends there or because we have a church or because we're connected to our schools or our neighborhoods, right? And that is the reality of the world that we live in. But the more that I mean, as you know, Marta, we talk about community all the time at LaBrie, and this is the question of like, of part of this longing in us, and I'm not feeling at home in the world, it's like we want to be connected. It's that tethering. We want to be tethered. We want to be connected. And I think that, I do think that proximity is a huge factor with that. And so the idea that you are very far from home, really impacts that and how we, I mean, I don't know what the big answer to this is other than to say yes and yes. And it is something to grieve. And I think we would all be better in just being kind of more intentional in how we make those decisions, to pick up and go. Because we were made for one another. It is not good for man to be alone. That verse is not just talking about marriage. That's true of all of us. And we need connection. We were built for that. That's how we thrive and flourish the best. And so to make choices that would facilitate that, which is easier said than done. I realize, but I don't know. Dueling Kaisers. Nick?
I've thought a lot about this, as you know. And the grief is the idea of soulscape. This is my home, is where my soul is shaped. And that's the landscape.
Yeah.
And so much of that is tied to rest and being taken care of. And so I don't rest here like I rest on the West Coast. My dad's in the Pacific Ocean is where I get the deepest rest.
Yeah.
But learning to rest here as an acknowledgement that this is where I live now and this is where my home is now, has been it is a grieving process, but it is a good one. But the recognition of being safe and resting, like that is tied to home.
Yeah.
The learning to know that that God is still with me in this space and I can have rest here. And that being enough.
Yeah.
But that is a deep grief.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. I was thinking when I was preparing this that people who know me, I'm like a total beach person. I love the beach. I'm not a hiker. I'm not a camper. I'm not a climber. I don't want to hang out in mountains. That's just not my jam. I love the beach, but I grew up in the mountains and there's still something in that. As much as I love the ocean and the shore and the beach, it's not actually in me in the way that mountains are in me. And that when I go to, it's the same type of thing. I go to East Tennessee and it's like, there is this kind of a sense of rest and a sense of place, that I don't have here. And it's
a comfort.
Connected. It's a comfort. Yeah. Yeah. And that's something Michaela's talked about a lot. Yeah. Finn?
I just was thinking about sort of the big biblical picture. And I'm just thinking about how maybe for the Israelites, the temple in Jerusalem, there wasn't this division between a spiritual home and a physical home because God was in the temple. You know, the temple was this physical place where they met with God. And in exile, this longing for Jerusalem wasn't just a longing for my hometown. It was a longing for the place where God has met us.
Yeah, it's a great point.
So there's a sort of spiritual and the physical are joined together so clearly in the Old Testament because God says, build a house for me there. Not that that was the only place God was, obviously, but there's a connection between place and heaven. And I'm just wondering whether Christians take a wrong turn somewhere because, you know, with Jesus' words to the woman he meets by the well, where he says, you know, the time is coming where it doesn't matter where you worship God, people will worship God everywhere in spirit and truth. It's almost like, I feel like a lot of Christians take that and think, now place doesn't matter. Now we just think about the spiritual. Yeah. We can be anywhere.
The Holy Spirit is with us wherever we go.
Where I'm wondering more whether it's more that no, actually Christ will now be everywhere, and you, in the way in which you meet Him is by engaging in place. It's just not tied to one spot anymore.
Yeah.
The way in which we see Christ is very often by staying put and by engaging with a certain group of people and sticking with them. So it's not as if those things are unimportant. And I think the danger for me is getting into this kind of dualistic, keep your eye on the spiritual and don't get too hung up on the physical place. To me, that it's not that this world isn't our home, it's that this world as it isn't our home. Because this world actually is our home.
Yeah, it is.
Both right now in a broken sense, but also one day when there's a new heaven and a new earth. There will be continuity between what we see now and what will be then, although it will be new. And so the language of this world is not our home, instead of we're pilgrims here, is very true, I think, but it's not a division between the spiritual realm and this filthy earth. It's about this world as it is now is not our home.
Yep.
So I don't know. It's just a couple of thoughts. I'm just wondering whether the Israelites maybe had a had a more grounded sense of spirituality. Like, this is, you know, because of this presence of God in this temple in this particular town.
And they had this collective history of wandering in the wilderness and the tabernacle and literally going from place to place and God going with them, the presence of God being very physically with them. Yeah, Sarah?
On the history piece, and sort of maybe as another way of phrasing your question, Martez, thinking, you know, how does transience or just mobility affect our sense of identity? And thinking how much identity is tied to memory, and the way that place and people groups, whether it's a culture or a family or a hometown, teachers that knew you when, you know, whatever, like there's shared memory. And that, I think that is very much connected to a sense of identity too.
Yeah.
And knowing and being known and being part of something that's bigger than me as an individual, but actually gives me a sense of my individuality and that I'm known by others. And yeah, just like the impact of moving on us, in that nobody knows. Nobody knows me when I was. You know, and they only know me insofar as I share stories or show pictures or maybe they'll come visit someday, you know, that sense of now I'm the only one that carries that memory, and it's fading. Because I'm living my life right now, you know.
We need other people to help us remember, don't we?
So anyway, I'm curious, I guess, for all of it, like how to that role of memory, remembering, sharing collective memory. What does that look like in kind of a socially fragmented
I think that's a great question. Anybody have any thoughts on that particular thing that Sarah just mentioned?
I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I just keep thinking about, I wonder if it has something to do with when we're growing up, we are so dependent on everybody else to be raised up. And so, and we are growing, and that's what's shaping us at that moment in time. And then, however, you know, 17, 18, 19, whatever, when you go off on your own now, it's up to you. So I wonder if that's why there's a lot of that feeling that we get to, like you said, your home feels there. And, you know, if you had a good upbringing, you go home, and that's the best seat you ever get is to meet your parents' house. And just these ties, whether it's with a friend when you were a child, or a parent, or anybody in your family, or people who you grew up with, because you were being molded at that time and shaped who you are. I don't know, I think maybe that's where the nostalgia comes in, too.
Yeah, and we've had these, our most formative experiences and memories are done in the context, typically with other people and with community. Yeah, shared, Dick, did you have something you wanted to say on that?
Yeah, I just have to untangle good from bad nostalgia, I think. I grew up and had a very rich childhood, and there was lots of good things, lots of good memories. But I know for sure that it wasn't as good as I remember it. I mean, it was don't remember a lot of the garbage and a lot of the anxiety and guilt and so on and homesickness and all that stuff. But I've sort of associated nostalgia, that's of looking back, as something that was kind of self-indulgent and self-deceptive. It would make me less satisfied with today and where I am now and what God is wanting me to do now and function where I am now with the people. And more say, oh, well, you know, it's not quite what it used to be, or this was different, or that was different. And I'm just wondering how to retrieve a good side of nostalgia, which I'm not really familiar with, positive development of that word. And leave the bad stuff behind. behind. Do you have any help on that?
Well, I mean, and to a certain extent, we're sort of trusting ourselves to be able to determine what was good and what was bad, right? Yeah. To be the one to kind of draw the line, which is tricky. I mean, I think part of the reason you're not familiar with the better use of that word is that it's just not typically used that way. I mean, yeah. I mean, kind of what I shared is like a really kind of at a core level of the root of the word, and it's obviously evolved, the use of that word has evolved over time. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think if you go back to this idea that it is this ache for home, and maybe this idea of home in a bit of a broader sense of not like 7128 Beacon Lane in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which was the house, right? But those things that home represented or that home gave us. And I think many of those things are good things to desire and are good things to work for and are good things to strive for. And so, to kind of shift that of what does it look like? What does it look like to cultivate those things now? And what does it look like to ask God for those things, right? To look to God to be the one to give us those things, whether it's a sense of security, a sense of freedom, a sense of love and acceptance, you know, whatever the things are.
And biblically, to see it as in the future.
Yeah, right, 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 yeah.
Something that is there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to... Lenny, did you have your hand up earlier on that or no, Jed? No.
No,
okay.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
The actual Greek words.
Right. Yeah.
That nostalgia comes from are the word for longing and the word for home.
Yeah.
That's the root of the actual word, and so he's trying to recover that and say that it's talking about something that's built into us and is a longing for home, and then. Apply all these things,
right?
A temporal home, but a permanent home.
Yeah,
it's a feature of our humanness.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Did you? I don't know your name. Right behind me.
I'm Zach.
Hi, Zach.
I've never been here before.
Oh, well, welcome. Thank you for coming.
I keep thinking I'm originally from West Virginia, and I keep moving north whether I want to or not.
Yeah. It's funny how that works.
And I know of an author from Moorhead, Kentucky, who wrote a series of fiction stories, and one of them is about a girl named Leanne Hawkins, and her town grooms her to become something. And they're grooming her to go off and make something big out of her life. And when she does that, and she comes back to visit, it says, but she's not one of us anymore. And she doesn't know what to do with that. And she, in a vulnerable moment, she shares with her sorority sisters, this is what my town wants me to be, but this is who I want to be, and they laugh. And they say, well, that's the silliest thing on earth. Why would you ever want to do that? And she eventually takes her own life.
Mm-hmm.
And I come from that. I come from a very small town where my name wasn't necessarily known, but Patty and Kevin were my parents, or Lewis and Martha.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a line in that story where it says, you know, England towns, they're known by their old churches, but towns in Appalachia are known by their homecoming queens and their basketball teams.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm longing, I'm now living in Connecticut, and I'm longing to be known, and kind of, I can't think of a better word, but owned also.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, we've been talking about the negative or the positive of that nostalgia. The negative is to just feel totally isolated, which I have felt for some time. Or the positive is to turn that into a longing for heavenly home, which leads me to bring others with me to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you for sharing that. It reminds me of, this has changed a bit, but when I was growing up in Chattanooga, we used to always say that when people asked you where you went to school, they're not asking where you went to college, they're asking where you went to high school. Yeah. And in that sense, I've had that experience as well of the, here, I'm the southerner.
Mm-hmm.
And at home in Chattanooga, you know, I'm a bit of a turncoat. You know, I left and I never came back. And so what kind of judgment am I laying out on? Yeah. But I like the what you said about the idea of bringing others with you, you know. And I think that, I mean, even the things that have already been said about community and kind of doing this together in a shared history, and even that verse in Jeremiah of it's very much about building relationships and you know, seeking the prosperity of the city together, right? It's this sense of doing something together in light of the bigger reality and the bigger destination. And I think, again, to Martha's point, it's a challenging thing to do in this day and time, but I think that instinct is good and that's right, and this idea of a collective is helpful. Yeah. Other people? Yeah.
It's not about the nostalgia, about separating the good and bad nostalgia. I don't know. To some degree, what our minds selectively remember, we don't have a lot of choice over, necessarily. Mm-hmm. We just don't remember the things we don't remember. But I wonder whether our view of our past, we can tell when it's healthy if it causes us to be generous to the people around us now. You know, I think of this as you know, if I, and I know it's unhealthy when it causes me to get frustrated at the now, frustrated at, you know, if I have some glorified image of my childhood as being this heavenly, amazing existence, and it's really unrealistic, that I am going to constantly be frustrated at my family for not measuring up to what I think, you know, family life should be. But if I have a more balanced and accurate and healthy view of my own past, it can cause me to actually be kind and patient and actually contribute some of the good and wholesome memories to my children's lives.
And trying to cultivate
some bad ones.
Yeah, and trying to cultivate some of those things that seem like such gifts to you from your own experience.
So like, instead of like what drives you to, like if I'm just driven to be totally discontent with the present moment, then I need to stop and really question whether my view of the past is just totally skewed. That's one of the things that nostalgia does. It just makes you despise the present moment and the present company.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's always because of it skews it, though. I wonder, so, Sarah, really, you mentioned photographs or pictures, and I think so much of what nostalgia is it's an image, or it is perfection being imaged for us, and we hold on to that, but we often find ourselves in situations where we cannot image perfection the same way it was imaged for us, and we live in that tension often. So it's really difficult to figure out how to, you know, I don't think the trick is to find a way to hold on to the beauty of that image while not holding it, grasping it so tight that we don't actively seek to work with what's in front of us.
That's a great point.
Maybe it has the whole idea of what makes you feel at your home is when you're most comforted and loved by other people. Because God is loving us always and comforts us. And so when we are away from whoever brought us up and that comfort and love, and then we are on our own, we're always seeking that. And we are seeking it with other people and whatever. That comfort and love until we find whatever that is, and maybe you don't. But then that becomes your home. So whoever you're with, but then we all have to realize that that's not it either. It's always God. God always is going to be home for us, no matter where we are, because that's the only place you can see true comfort and that feeling of home.
Yeah, and I think it's something about the sense of just being able to be ourselves.
Right.
And children, especially younger children, are so unself-conscious most of the time about who they are, right? And that sense of you just get to be. And I think that's when we feel most at home or home somewhere, when we feel like we can just come as we are and we can be ourselves. But to your point, you're right, it's this internal struggle always of wanting to be seen and known, but then being terrified of that. Right? Because we want to be seen and known and loved. Like, there's a connection, right? Because the fear is that we'll be seen and not loved, or loved for something that we're not, right? While unseen. And so, this idea of being seen and loved, and that is what God has offered us through Christ, that we are can be fully ourselves and at home and loved by Him always.
The strangers or guests definitely got benefit from hospitality provided by the home, right? But the other side, you know, by embrace strangers and guests, you know, the host also got benefit.
Yeah.
So my question is it safe to say that, you know, like, home it keeps being shaped toward heavenly home. Mm-hmm. But one of the way being shaped is to embrace the strangers into home. This is because the Jesus always, you know, described kingdom of God as picture language of you know, the banquet or feast, embracing, you know, the weak, and strangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think this idea of, I was thinking, my colleague Ben has done a whole lecture on the hospitality of God. And so I think when we extend hospitality to others, when we welcome the stranger in, we are imaging God when we do that. We are mirroring Him. But I think you're absolutely right. As the host, we are shaped and we are changed as well. And so I think that absolutely, you know, ideally, right? There's always crazy things that happen with hospitality, but ideally it does move the family or the person. It does move us closer to that because we are doing the work of God, by extending hospitality, and welcoming others in. And we are also doing that when we allow ourselves to be welcomed in by others, right? Because that is part of it. That's part of it as well. Yeah. Other things?
Yeah. I can't help thinking, I was listening to just the two ideas or two concepts of home and identity. I think some kind of alluded to it already. When we talk about, especially when we refer to home as a temple, using more of the Christian language or biblical language. And as you refer to Revelation, there's, oh, there's no temple, it's just the Lamb or God that's being in the presence or being with God that's being home. And the identity as a Christian, we often talk about being in Christ. So this kind of connection, I'm not saying that, you know, home and identity is exactly the same thing, but it's, to me, it's so connected together, like, and this whole idea of being union with Christ. And then when you think about it in those terms, it's about a community. Again, it always comes back to a community. So when you think about home, you think about people. You're not thinking about the house, the building, right? It's just always about people, like relationship. It could be a bad one or a good one, because it always involves people. So this is idea of community wherever we go. I just find it kind of fascinating. Just in my mind, I was just kind of connect the dots. And I mean, for me, that has been a question for me, especially with identity. Is moving from different places. This is my kind of third country. I was living in three countries. Where do I actually belong? And when I'm in one country, that's my home. When I go back, actually, I don't really fit here anymore.
Right.
You know, I long for something else when I go over some, like, just always kind of just a personal fulfillment.
Yeah.
I have this longing in a sense, but if someone asks me, okay, you can go home, we'll give you a job, go back home where you grew up, I'll probably say no. You know, it's not the idea of that loneliness, but I'm not sure if I want to go back. Anyway, just kind of thinking out loud,
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a helpful connection with identity because it goes back to kind of what you were saying about, you know, we're ultimately at home with God, and that is because that is the true basis of our identity, is that we have been created as daughters and sons of God, and that is our primary identifier. It made me think of, there's a song by Sarah Groves. I don't know if you guys know Sarah Groves. She's a Christian songwriter, and she has a song called Painting Pictures of Egypt, and I'm not gonna be able to remember it, but the whole thing is this idea of, she's kind of singing, writing from the place of the Israelites leaving Egypt, and it's this whole thing she says, the future feels so hard, I want to go back. The Israelites wanting to go back to Egypt. She said, but the places that used to fit me can't hold the things I've learned. Those doors were closed off to me while my back was turned. And this idea that you're not exactly the same person you were, right? We grow and we change and we don't just easily necessarily fit back in. It doesn't mean we can't go back, but we don't fit back in the same way. And I think the more, for me at least, kind of the more I have those kinds of experiences in life, the more I see the need, both the need and the reality, that God is my home, and that is where that needs to be my primary identity marker. Because the more you go and change and move, and you try to go back and you try to hit reverse, and you can't. You can't do it. Yeah.
I think just part of that idea, maybe as a counterbalance, is to think about what you said about how, like, but we were still designed for this place, right? We shouldn't stick our head in the physical sand and say, well, I was built for heaven, and I'm gonna ride this thing out.
Yeah.
I think, like, Dallas Willard talks about it in Renovation of the Heart, where he says, like, this is the only place that we know that God allows his will to be, gone against. And we were designed to exist here. Mm. And so, like, this idea that we would wait for heaven to fully live out our purpose really isn't true. Like, mm-hmm. God designed us to worship him here.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it's wrapped up in what, like, Meredith was saying, about, like, feeling like a round peg in a square hole, because, mm-hmm. As we're, born and adapt ourselves to this world, we create this hole that we fit into.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I think that, like, what we're honestly trying to get to is that, like, God-shaped place, that's where we belong, and we're trying to adapt ourselves to something else.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, it's important to keep track of that, like, we're still here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that idea that we talk about, the kingdom of God is now, but it's also not yet. And this idea that I think the work of the Christian is to participate in God's work in bringing the kingdom, right? And again, it will not come in its fullness until Christ returns. But we are, he says, see, I'm making all things new. That's present tense. That's now.
Bringing
the welfare. Yeah. And making things new and participating in this ushering in of the kingdom. While we don't just kind of sit and wait for heaven to come, we work to help usher it in until the day that Jesus returns. Yeah. Yep. Elizabeth.
So I grew up with the phrase church home. I often think that as we look for those signposts that you were talking about, our spiritual home, and we're so tied in space and place, like there's such an emphasis on local church being a place where we can invest in and spend time with people, and everyone's been talking about community, but like being found in the local church. And then I was thinking about just the general state of homelessness in our country, and how oftentimes the Bible talks about reaching, like, the church is to reach out to the homeless, the fatherless, the widow, the orphan, and how, like, not only do we have a place within a community of other believers to focus on our spiritual home, but that is also a place where we can actively address homelessness together, as well in space and in place.
Yeah.
And I just think that's kind of like a beautiful picture all around that sort of works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Yes, thank you for that. thank you for bringing up the local church. What I thought of when you were saying is that the picture that John gives us in Revelation of the city and of the feast is, it's a wedding banquet, right? It is the wedding of the Lamb, and the church is the bride of Christ. I mean, that's what that is, right? And so, yeah, I think the church globally and the local church are a huge part of that. And I mean, kind of your bridge on that with homelessness is important, kind of what we were talking about before, because it's also easy to just sort of hunker down inside the church, right? And kind of just have that be, and have that be the orbit versus this idea of home being a place that we are tethered to, but that we go out from and we come back and we're cared for and we're stored, and then we go out again and we invite others in, you know, versus it being a, right, just a vacuum. Yeah. Helpful. Yeah. Other thing, Marta?
Again, some jumble of thoughts. Okay. It was very interesting just to listen to you know, your comments, because actually both the gentleman and the front set resonated with me that, you know, home is really a more community-based reality. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, when I think of home, I don't think of the house. I live in many houses, mm-hmm. but I still have a sense of home, mm-hmm. despite the fact that I live in many houses while living in Hungary.
Yeah.
Still in the same city. But that, you know, home is the relational aspect. You know, home is what you are missing is the people. So home is not necessarily a place, but it's still within a place. You know, it's mm-hmm. placed within a space and a place. Mm-hmm. But it's, you are born into that. You know, there is mm-hmm. that relational aspect that's already there.
Absolutely.
Anything.
Yep.
You are born and into that, and you grow up in that. And then you make choices and you invest relationships on your own as well. But that's, you know, as you talked about, so just the identity and the corporate context. And I think what happens is that we can think that we can create a home.
Mm.
You know, when you think you were listing all those shops,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not a bad thing to invest into your home, mm-hmm. but that's more an individualistic mindset that I can break out, I can step out of that corporate context,
mm-hmm.
which actually makes sense of my story. And mm-hmm. I think that's why it also resonated that Michaela said about rest, because this is what I feel when I go home. You feel like, I just make sense. I don't need to explain everything.
Yeah.
I don't need to second guess everybody's statements and between the lines.
Yeah.
I can just sit back and like, And it feels like that home is that place that reflects those three things about who God is,
mm-hmm.
who He is for us.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually are within that context in your earthly reality, it feels like it gives you more support.
Absolutely.
In life to just cope with
mm-hmm.
life. Because, mm-hmm. as I said, it takes energy. And then, as Michaela said, you don't have the same kind of capacity for rest.
Right.
You know, so it's, so if you can actually stick within your own context, I feel like that gives you more support, because we journey together in this
mm-hmm.
life. Yeah, I'm not just journeying by myself.
Mm-hmm.
You are given your family and friends, and then your spouse, and then your children, but it's always a corporate thing.
Mm-hmm.
So home is not just like, I'm going to create my own home. You know, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be then a house,
mm-hmm.
but it's not going to be the context of the corporate.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Something that struck me as you were saying is, I think, like you said, it's wise to invest in your home, but like, what are you creating, right? Are you creating a place that's conducive to build community, or are you building a fortress to shut out the rest of the world? Like, and I feel like that's the duality of this life, right? Like, there's so many things that God gives us that are so good, and like, the temptation is to pervert it a little bit towards, you know, what we want, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
just, you know, creating that space of home as, you know, what are we doing with that? So,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. I was thinking of, there's a book that, I haven't even read the whole thing, but, that we talk about sometimes, but this book by Andy Crouch called The TechWise Family, which is just a little book about technology that he's, but one of the things he talks about is in his own family, how they've created a culture in their home by the way that they've shaped their physical home to create spaces for people to be able to come in and to interact and to care for one another and to be creative and to do things versus, you know, in a very intentional way. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about a lot of different streams that have kind of been offered, and this might not make sense, so, but that's okay. I was just thinking about the fact that I wonder, it was extremely difficult, I'm sure, but I wonder if Israel's homelessness was at least bearable because they could reflect their stories back to each other, like they carried their home with them in a bit of a way. You know, so like, yes, they're in Babylon, but they can tell the stories, they can have that relaxed feeling.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, when you're talking, Marcia, when you're speaking, I was thinking about, I was like, man, I wish the church was like that. I wish that, like, when I came into the church, I was like, oh, I don't have to explain myself. Most of the time, I'm like, oh, man, I need to explain myself. And, like, I guess there's a part of me that just longs for that, for the church. Well, at the same time, there's another part of me that's like, wow, the church, even in its very beginning, was Jews who were like, okay, we don't have to explain ourselves. This is how we do this. And then non-Jews who were like, who are you? And why do you do it this way? And I don't understand you. And so, like, from its inception, it was both meant to be this place of home and you're known and you're loved and you're accepted. And yet, at the same time, it was this, let's learn how to be at home. Let's learn how, you know. And so that, I don't know, that's just a really interesting tension to think about, how it's both. And I just really appreciated, like, just some other streams, like even, you know, Zach saying about the tension of, like, so longing for that and yet at the same time becoming that person that walks someone else home. You know, it's just really, really interesting. And it also reminded me, too, of Anna's lecture a couple weeks ago about Ruth and Naomi and the way that God works through incredibly ordinary things like friendship to accomplish these unbelievably rich and beautiful and healing purposes. I don't know, just really, really fascinating. I think there's some threads that are weaving through all of that.
That's a great connection. I mean, because that's really a story of Ruth is essentially saying to Naomi, like, I will be your home. I will be home for you. That's the promise that she makes to her. Yeah.
And then Naomi says, I won't rest until you have a home.
I the talk I gave this morning to a different group was on Sabbath, and it's something I've spoken on before, but one of the things that I'm always struck by is that how much easier it seems it would be to practice Sabbath if it's something that we did as a community. And for the Jews, they very much did that in community. And there's a quote that talks about the Jews kept Sabbath, but that Sabbath kept the Jews. And so even at times in their collective history in exile, in Nazi Germany, that this shared history and this shared practice together, they kept Sabbath, but it kept them as well in these times where they were displaced and how, you know, but that community aspect is big. Yeah. Allison. Just yell at me.
I just had a quick comment from Kendall.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating the diversity of God's creation and the way in which there are people groups today that are still nomadic and live like in harmony with the land. In ways that Ben was talking about one of his lectures about. I just feel like it's fascinating to see the way in which God directs people differently at different times in their lives.
Yeah.
If he wants us to go, we shouldn't stay. We should go. But the some of the diversity within the body of Christ, we won't always be going and coming by his bidding at the same time.
Yeah, it's a good
so
point.
I think this idea of like church as a place where we can just be like, awesome, I don't have to explain myself. Mm-hmm. I think that would be awesome when it comes in heaven. And if we can all kind of get each other's like, well, you're Jesus told you go there, okay, like, oh my gosh. Yeah. We're supposed to be here, like, welcome.
Yeah.
We see you, we know you. We want to, what was it, own you, see you, and claim you.
That's a great point. Yeah. It's hard to imagine, isn't it, what that would look like in the church today. It's possible. All things are possible with God.
Yeah, I think
wonderful that there's no one place that has to be the holy place to go. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to fight over it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have to fight over a holy city or a holy mountain or a holy building or something like this. But other people are still fighting over it.
Yeah.
And they'll be in the future.
Yeah.
But God is everywhere. But we also need to, and I think it's come up in a bunch of places, to our continuity is with people. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we've got to have some people that are some continuity in time. And I think the general idea for the last 25 years or so in this part of the world is that people move between every 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think unless we lean against that, we are deciding to be lonely. Mm-hmm. We are deciding to not be able to form the connections that we really want. Now, obviously, you could do that once or twice, but if the whole pattern is following modernity, mm-hmm. which is demanding you to move that often, then that's a decision to not have the kind of connectiveness that a church, because what can you do for a church if you just come in and out every 3 years? Yeah. Another church. So I think there needs to be a conscious standing against what modernity is demanding of us, mm-hmm. if we want to, if we want the things that God promises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. The idea too of that, those types of connections and things take time, and mm-hmm. not very many things in our world take time anymore. I mean, things are so quick and automatic, and I think we get used to that. And the idea of having to really walk alongside people and choose to invest, and when it's interesting and also when it's no longer interesting, and when it's easy and when it's no longer easy, and to stay in that. And there's very little in our culture that encourages that. Right? And I think that's a great point of that it has to be a really a very conscious choice to push back against that. Yeah. Nick?
I have thought quite a lot about this idea in Ephesians of that he's put eternity in the hearts of man, the idea of home longing and nostalgia, that this is something that was put into us to long. Mm-hmm. We all long for this. Mm-hmm. It is not just a few of us who have a longing mm-hmm. to be known and loved. That it's a reflection of the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. That one day we will know ourselves, like that we are known by God, mm-hmm. and we will be at rest because we are known fully mm-hmm. by ourselves and by one another. Mm-hmm. And this idea of being an eternity in the hearts of men means everyone longs for this.
Yeah.
And we can be a reflection mm-hmm. of that, the reality of that now mm-hmm. to one another. Mm-hmm. And so it is a connection to people, that mm-hmm. everyone feels this is a homelessness in some way. Mm-hmm. So be generous, be hospitable, mm-hmm. be gracious. Mm-hmm. And that's a way that we can reflect this idea of eternity that is in our hearts.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Sorry, me again. Mm-hmm. Like how once a year.
Milk it for all it's worth.
No, I was just thinking, going back to your point a bit, if you get what I'm trying to say, is that I think there is a certain way we are not actually articulate about what home means until we leave it. Mm-hmm. So, because you are sort of born into that, and it becomes.
It's the water you're swimming in,
yes,
so you don't,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you take it for granted, and unless you actually leave it, you know, I couldn't have explained to you what it meant to be a Hungarian until I moved to England, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay, the English are like this, mm-hmm. you know, and they think this way, or they speak this way, or they relate this way. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I think that nostalgia, that home sickness also becomes more articulate when you realize what you lost, and you mm-hmm. can actually put mm-hmm. words to it and recognize it. So in a sense, I want to say in a sense it's a good thing, because at least you actually come to terms, you realize what you had.
Yeah, it wakes us up to that reality. Yeah.
So it's like if your tribe is always fed, you can tell them as much as you like, you know, it's really bad to be hungry, it really feels bad and awful to not mm-hmm. have food, but until they get hungry, they won't actually appreciate the fact that they are fed every single night. So mm-hmm. the same, you know, with home, then as long as you are in it, you sort of take it for granted and you might not be quite as faithful as mm-hmm. when you lose it, and then you realize what are those actually key points that make home what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Okay.
You get to go. I'm gonna go.